providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed the earlier conversations with a couple fund managers focused more in the, let's say, metals sector. In the final couple segments here, we are going to be shifting focus to the energy sector as we are chatting again with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Now, Dan, I have to say you have become pretty quickly one of our listeners and ours favorite energy analysts, especially when it comes to diving down into the stocks. I know Shad and I read over your material on a regular basis, especially the company stuff. We will get into some of the energy companies that you're following that you still think have some good opportunities here. But since we're talking energy, I do want to start with the oil price. And as much as we've talked to you and other resource analysts out there, there does seem to be a lot of bullish factors that should be playing in to a stronger oil price. We do need to consider, and we are recording this about halfway through the day on Wednesday. Oil is still right around, let's say, $73 a barrel. Overall, you look back to last year, any years before that, this is a strong and high oil price, but it is off of its highs. And really, since June, the price has been trending lower. Dan, in this environment where we're hearing about so many bullish factors that should be driving oil, why is oil being pulled down?
Well, I think part of it could be that the price you see on the news is based on the trading of the front month NYMEX futures contracts. And there are a lot more non-physical traders, like I call them paper traders. They're trading those contracts and they have no ability to deliver oil or take the oil when they get to the maturity date of the contract. And because the price has been falling and a lot of these guys trade on margin, they're getting margin calls. So when there's a bullish storage report that like came out Wednesday, U.S. crude oil inventories actually declined further, 5.2 million barrels from the previous week, despite the fact that the in America we're drawing oil out of our strategic petroleum reserve to put into commercial reserves, we're still falling. And you would have thought that would, and initially the price went up about 50 cents or a dollar and immediately then started coming back as, you know, these traders set, you know, they reset their stop loss orders tighter. And then when it starts going down, it can create a cascade, a sell off. But also in the storage report, I mean, distillate inventories are still 9% below where they should be this time of year. Distillates is, home heating oil and diesel, very important to our economy. Gasoline, we're kind of in a low period, except for the holiday travel. We're in a low period in the winter for gasoline demand. But other than that, all of our three primary inventories, crude oil, gasoline, and distillates, are all below the five-year average. And demand is actually going up. I mean, you look on the positive side, you got, and the only thing I can say is physically in the real market, the physical market that is keeping this down is the fear of recession. I mean, they nonstop talk about, you know, the Fed's raising interest rates nonstop and they're definitely going to stop inflation. And basically everybody believes it's going to cause a recession. Well, that fear is the only thing I can keep because the global oil market is extremely tight. And some of the things that came up recently, you look at them, they're really bullish signals for the market.
Well, Dan, yeah. I mean, to that point, OPEC, when they've been questioned about it, everybody was hoping that they would increase supply. Not only have they said they're going to hold the line, but some people are still worried they may cut supply. And then you have things like the seasonality factor. You know, starting in Q1, the U.S. will probably produce less. So you have less supply that's going to be coming to market with relatively high demand. Do you think this is maybe just an equilibrium point for the market, or are those fears of recession so big that any good news is still seen as bad news because they're worried about what the Fed's going to do?
Yeah, I think that's it. It's when you're in a bear market, either in the stock market or in the commodities market, it's when you're really in a bear market, stuff that even looks like good news, they take as bad news. And there may be five good things and one bad thing, and they focus on the bad thing. But let me make a few points here, listeners. There is a global energy crisis, and it's not just crude oil, it's everything. And inventories are way low. OECD inventories are at dangerous levels and they continue to fall on a days of consumption basis. The situation in Europe, because they're cut off from Russian supplies of both natural gas and oil. And then they just the other day passed a price ceiling on Russian crude oil. Some people think it's too high because Russia is actually selling their Urals oil at prices below that already. So they don't think that's going to take much oil off the market. But the teeth of that price ban was that no tanker companies can get insurance. And most of the insurance comes out of Europe for the shipping companies. And if they do contracts of more than $60 a barrel for the other brands, because there's higher quality Russian oil that's selling, you know, maybe only a 10 or 15 a dollar discount to a WTI. And if they ship that at over $60 a barrel, they're going to get cut off. And then some people say, well, China and India, they'll ignore that. They don't want to be cut off from European insurance companies, and they don't want to really piss off the Europeans too much, because in the long run, that could really come back to hurt them. So I don't know. I watched a presentation today on that. And I believe that the price cap will eventually take 1 million barrels of Russian oil off the market. And it's already a tight market. And then if you have a cold winter, Europe's going to eat up their home heating oil demand inventories very quickly. So I think we're a long way from getting out of the situation in Europe. And it's very, you know, very early in the winter to think that we're going to have some kind of warm winter across all of Europe.
So, Dan, is there anything negative that you are worried about for this sector? I guess outside of a recession, which it sounds like that narrative is going to stick with us into next year. And who knows if we even get a recession next year. But anything else that would make you pull back on that generally overall bullish outlook for oil?
Yeah, I am definitely very bullish on natural gas and bullish on oil, too. But, you know, if the situation in China, I mean, they just today on Wednesday, they lowered their restrictions for COVID, that zero COVID policy. And they're letting, you know, people get out of their apartments and stuff because of the riots they had. I think the people themselves have had enough and the government knows that. And I don't think those lockdowns and stuff were doing much to curb the spread of COVID anyway. If they would come back and just get worse and worse on these restrictions, yeah, that could really hurt their economy. But, you know, as long as the Chinese economy stabilizes and the Indian economy stabilizes, demand for energy just goes up year after year. It's relentless because the population of the earth now over 8 billion people, more people equals more demand for all kinds of energy. One thing I'll tell you, I went to a conference on Monday in Houston, and very smart people, honest people out of NASA and everything, and a lot of these PhDs. And one of the panel discussions was on the energy transition. And I was very pleased to hear nothing about wind and solar being part of it. They really understand now that wind and solar is not going to make a dent in oil demand. And nor is it going to make a dent in carbon emissions. And so now their big thing is carbon capture and sequestration to reduce the carbon level. But I mean, if we're the only ones doing it and China and India aren't doing it, then so what? And then the other thing, they think there's an opportunity for hydrogen to become more a mixture of transportation fuels. And I've heard that before, and that's probably true. But to scale it up to the size enough to reduce gasoline and diesel demand, we're years away. They admit that too. This is nothing that's going to happen in the next couple of years. It's maybe 5-10 years away at the minimum.
Well, Dan, let's shift over to the companies, because in this kind of environment, let's just say $72-$73 oil and around $5.50 on nat gas, a lot of the companies built their models on lower prices anyway. So a lot of the companies we've talked to said, hey, they would be fine even if oil pulled back to 60, or maybe some of them even in the 50s. Same thing with nat gas. They built their models on 4. So what do you think is the overall health of the companies if prices just hovered where they are currently?
Yeah, you said, you know, heading into 2022, everybody's budgets were assuming maybe $60 oil. And they were banking on that. So they were just unbelievably pleased and got off to a great start. Well, the good thing about the companies, because of that surge in the oil price, and they were able to harvest some of that, and because of their discipline, I was really pleased to see the companies that we follow. And I follow like 38 energy companies, and they've stuck with their program. They haven't gone out and added a bunch of rigs. In fact, they can't because the oil field service companies have been so damaged. They don't have the people. They don't have the equipment. So, and tubulars have been a big problem too. So production has not gone up, but they've used that free cash flow. Their balance sheets are in great shape. Some of these companies that I look at, these small caps that I thought were on the verge of bankruptcy in 2020 are now virtually debt free. They have ratios, debt to enterprise value ratios below one that I've never seen. Our debt to EBITDA way below one time. Some of them at 0.5 or zero. They have no debt and they really look good. And if they just get oil prices in the 60s or 70s, they're going to have great years in 2023. And I can tell you, I think this too shall pass with the traders. I think once we can get a stabilized price, they resolve their margin call issues. And then, you know, I think you'll see them starting adding back to their long positions because the global oil market is extremely tight. And the thing I want to make to your listeners too, OPEC is in control of the oil price. There is no other excess production capacity outside of the OPEC Plus cartel group. Most of them can't even make their current quotas. And so Saudi Arabia, UAE, a couple of the other countries, maybe four or five countries total in all of OPEC have any excess capacity. So as long as they stick together, and I think they want $80 oil, they probably want like $90 or $100 oil. I think they'll let it stay low for a while because they don't want to, you know, add to the global recession that would hurt them in the long run. But those countries need those oil revenues in order to survive.
Dan, have you ever seen an environment like this when it comes to the companies essentially being debt-free or at least having a short-term path to being debt-free, making money in the sector, even though the oil price is trending lower? Have you seen this environment where the companies are this healthy?
Yeah, and I can tell you, I talked to the CEOs and they think their stocks are grossly undervalued. No, I haven't. I've been in this industry for close to 40 years or more than 40 years, actually, and I see really solid companies trading at less than 3x cash flow, and their balance sheets are in good shape. They have a lot of running room. They have a lot of low-risk inventory. One of the companies I follow closely, InPlay Oil, I went to their deal. They have got 60, what he calls tier one development drilling locations that at the current oil price would pay out in like 8 or 9 months. Man, when I was at Hess, we had projects that paid out in 3 years, we were happy. And some of his better wells literally are paying out in 3 or 4 years. But that's the same story across the whole group that I look at. All the peer groups are trading at incredibly low valuations based on operating cash flow. And that's what I value them on. Not really on net income or anything like that. But the main things are, you know, strength of balance sheet, strength of their drilling inventory, their ability to fund growth with their own operating cash flow so they don't need to go get bank loans or anything like that. And I really do think after the first year, if things settle down, the oil price starts creeping up again, Europe survives, we get through that period, I think there's going to be more and more money managers rotate money into this sector because these companies are making money. They're making a lot of money at these current prices.
Well, Dan, the other theme of 2022 for the energy space has been return to shareholders. I mean, people have seen record dividends. There's been special dividends. There's been share buybacks. Do you think some of that will start shifting over into more growth or acquisitions as we move into 2023?
Yeah, I think if you take money managers that don't really know much about the sector, what they're going to be comfortable with is the larger companies with strong balance sheets that are paying dividends. So at least they have the dividend income, you know, and we have a high yield income portfolio, model portfolio. There's 13 companies in it. The average yield is 9%, with some of them up to 12 or 13% dividend yield. One of the best companies in the portfolio is Pioneer Natural Resources. Based on my forecast, they're going to be able to pay out like $25 to $26 in dividends next year. Now the stock trades for like $250. So, you know, but that's a 10% yield based on the current share price on a company that is just rock solid. They don't really even know what to do with all their free cash flow. So they're just going to probably just keep raising their dividends, and they're buying back a lot of their stock. So the denominator, the number of shares outstanding, keeps going down. So the per share numbers just keep looking better and better.
Dan, how would you recommend somebody analyze the stability of the dividends, even special dividends that are getting paid out to shareholders?
Yeah, if you want to look at their hedge book to see what they do have a hedging policy. Some of these guys don't have anything hedged because once they pay off all their debt, it's the debt holders that require the hedging most of the time. But a lot of them are now able to use collars that have high ceilings. So they have exposure to the higher prices, but they have floors set on their hedges that keep them positive cash flow. Now, a lot of them are now have there's a fixed plus variable dividends, and the majority of their dividends are the variable dividends. So they maybe pay like Pioneer may a dollar of their quarterly dividend is fixed, but then their variable portion has been run at $5 or $6. So that could go up and down a little bit, but they have such strong cash. And another thing, their operating expenses are way down too. I mean, a lot of these horizontal wells flow, they're not pumped. They don't require electricity or anything, and their operating cash flow is only like $10 or $12. So for them to go cash flow negative on operations, you would have to get the oil price down below 30 before you'd even see that them being cash flow negative on their operations.
Dan, do you think we'll see companies put more focus on growth as we move into new year? Because again, it's been on the dividends, it's been on return to shareholders, but are you looking at companies that have a solid growth wedge?
Yeah, I really like, in fact, both of our model portfolios for the upstream companies are called the Sweet 16 Growth Portfolio and the Small Cap Growth Portfolio. So I do want to see growth. I want to see growth funded by operating cash flow. So if you can have that and they're paying dividends and they're growing their proven reserves, at the end of the day, the valuation of any upstream company is going to be the net present value of their reserves, of their proven reserves. And several of these companies are trading below PV10, their future cash flows from their proven reserves, discounted by 10%, less debt, less all their debt divided by the number of shares, and they're trading below that number. No upstream company should ever do that, because that makes them an extremely attractive takeover target, especially if they have a lot of probable reserves. They have a lot of undrilled acreage. When I was at Hess, I did business development. We were always looking for takeover targets. And if we could find companies with a lot of acreage, because basically we thought we were getting the acreage for free, if we could buy them for a decent multiple of cash flow, and we've at times paid up to 5 or 6 times operating cash flow. So that's what I look for. And this is sustainability, and look at their discipline. But because their balance sheets are in such strong position, I would say that all the companies that I'm following now, none of them, literally none of them, have any near-term debt issues because they paid down their debt so far.
So, Dan, why aren't we seeing more M&A action then? It sounds like a ripe environment for companies to be taken over.
We have seen some M&A. The M&A has been the public companies buying out private companies. Two of the companies I follow, I'll give you, Earthstone Energy has closed on like 6 private transactions, and they've gone from 30,000 barrels a day of production to 100,000 barrels a day. And I would tell you, that's really my top pick in our Sweet 16 right now. And they aren't getting the attention that they're due. And the last deal just recently closed to push them over 100,000 barrels a day. And their year-end report, their year-end balance sheet, their year-end reserve report is going to show that stock's trading for well below breakup value. And another one is Northern Oil and Gas. That symbol is NOG. Earthstone is ESTE. Northern Oil and Gas is NOG. And they've made 4 or 5 private transactions this year. They're a non-op company. They don't operate anything. So their model depends heavily on the quality of their operators, that's one of the things they really look at carefully. But they've grown production significantly. And so that, as far as companies adding a lot of rigs to go out there and drilling, I'm only seeing a few that are adding 1 or 2 more rigs. So first of all, there's not quality rigs, quality equipment, and quality people to throw out there right now. The service companies are pretty much maxed out at this point.
Dan, what about adding land? Because a lot of these companies are cashed up. Their balance sheets are better than they've ever been. Could they add more acreage? Could they add more basins? Is there any companies you see poised to do that?
Yeah, there's some of them, and what they're doing, they call bolt-on deals. They're buying out some of their non-operating partners in their wells. There's always, some little acreage packages are coming due. And actually, the pullback in the oil and gas prices actually makes M&A easier, because now the sellers cannot say, well, yeah, but we got $100 oil and I want you to value my property as $100 oil. So it makes the negotiation to buy stuff a lot easier.
Dan, there's certain jurisdiction that you're a bit more focused on in terms of where you think there's more opportunity for growth, where production is more stable, even where governments will more or less stay out of the way of energy companies.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. And obviously, I like the Texas-based fields. I think the Permian Basin, obviously, is the U.S.'s most important oil field and probably one of the three or four most important oil fields in the world. It still has a lot of running room. There is one problem with the Permian. They've grown so fast, they've kind of maxed out their pipeline takeaway capacity. So that's a problem. The Eagle Ford looks more attractive to me than it was a year or so ago. It does have plenty of pipeline takeaway capacity. It's on the gas side. It's much closer to the Gulf of Mexico. So it has direct access to some of the large LNG export facilities along the Gulf Coast. On the pure natural gas side, I love the Haynesville. One of the companies I like is Comstock Resources. It has a large acreage position in the Haynesville. The Haynesville is in eastern Louisiana. It's very close to Henry Hub, Louisiana, which there is, seven or eight large pipelines out of that hub where they can get their gas to the best markets. And they also have direct access to big LNG export facilities in the eastern side of Texas and in Louisiana. And that's where some of the big export facilities are. So I like those regions. The Bakken weather this time of year is a little bit of a problem. We have in the Appalachian, the Marcellus and Haynesville are, and Marcellus and Utica plays. They're kind of pipeline constrained. They can only build production so much. But those companies, they had hedged a lot of gas at really low prices. So those hedges fall off at the end of the year. They were not even getting $5 gas. So if they would have a full year getting $5 gas, they're going to have great years. So look at some of those Appalachian companies too.
Well, Dan, just to that point, as far as the strength of nat gas, it has even bifurcated from oil a couple times recently where it was still heading higher even while oil was correcting. Are you more encouraged by that moving into next year, the nat gas companies over the oil companies? Or do you like some of the hybrid companies where they got a nice mix of both?
Yeah, I personally like to own companies that have a lot of a good mix, and that's oil, natural gas, and NGLs, because that's kind of a natural hedge, because those markets are really totally different from each other. The oil price is set on the global market, and the natural gas and NGLs, to a lesser extent, are set on the regional market. I also like natural gas because more and more, it is the clean fossil fuel. So when you hear about, in fact, the thing I went to on Monday, this panel on the transition, energy transit, they realize that wind and solar isn't going to work. The best thing they can do is transition away from coal-fired power plants to more natural gas-fired power plants. I think that trend around the world is going to be a big deal. I think refilling Europe's natural gas storage facilities next summer is going to be tougher than it was even this past summer. I think demand for U.S. LNG is going to go through the roof. Freeport's still not online. They pushed it back even three or four more weeks. So when the Freeport LNG export facility comes back online, we're going to have 14, 15 BCF a day of LNG export capacity. But just gas, because it's getting more favorable as the clean fuel. So I'm excited about that. I think long term it looks really good. And natural gas was trading for $2 to $3 for like 14 years. So these guys are happy as a clam that it's up to $5 even.
Dan, kind of stepping back for a second here, is there any companies or anybody out there that's innovating in this sector, finding better ways to extract the either natural gas or oil, finding better ways to refine it? Really any technological advances here within the energy sector that you're watching?
Well, one company and I really like, and I think it's a great value right now, is Taos Energy, T-A-L-O-S. Its symbol is T-A-L. They are developing a carbon capture and sequestration business that they believe could be very profitable, especially under the new tax law, the Inflation Reduction Act. There's all kind of credits in there for carbon capture. And they control numerous offshore facilities in the shallower water on the shelf, where they can pump CO2 and massive amount of CO2 into those depleted reservoirs. And they've already got a partnership with, I believe it's Chevron or somebody, has already partnered with them on this project. And that could be a pretty neat thing. Also, just across the board, I mean, these targeted well completions, they are now able to log the entire horizontal section of a horizontal well, which might be 2 miles long. And then they can design the frack. Instead of fracking just every 200 feet or 300 feet, they are placing their fracks, and they have diverters and everything that they can get the frack sand, you know, the most frack sand into those zones that are already naturally fractured a little bit, and they can get the most out of those frack jobs. So that increases the recovery reserves from those wells, and it also brings them on at a lot higher rate. So I like that. And some of the larger companies like Pioneer, Diamondback, Devon, they're all kind of on the cutting edge of these completion techniques.
Well, Dan, just one other area we really haven't touched on much. I know you don't follow it as closely, but the oil services sector. I got a question about diesel. We've got a diesel shortage. Are there opportunities in the refineries? Are there opportunities for investors to get into that? Because it's such a weird market right now where it seems like there's a choke point at the refineries. I just didn't know if you see any opportunity in that area.
Yeah, you know, the ones that you know, have the ability to, and I don't follow them that closely, so I can't really tell you which refiners, but the ones that are going to get these crack spreads on the diesel. I saw a report the other day that said we literally could see diesel going to double digits per gallon. It's going to be that short. We needed the heavy oil from Canada. That's what we needed the Keystone Pipeline for. The Canadian government itself has kind of slowed development of their oil sands projects. That's also heavy oil that's good for making distillates out of. What people need to understand is you cannot make diesel and heating oil out of the super light oil out of the shale plays. It's too thin. It's a high gravity, which means it's lighter. So, some of it is literally clear. I mean, you're looking at a jar of water. When you look at it, it's clear, and you could put it right into your car. I don't advise doing that, but you could, I guess, for a while. But you need a heavier hydrocarbon molecule to make distillates, and this world runs on distillates. I mean, most of us drive gasoline cars and we buy gasoline, but I can tell you farm equipment runs on diesel, heavy equipment, like, you know, bulldozers and stuff, and all the mining equipment runs on diesel. If the world runs out of diesel, it's a it's a bigger problem than running out of gasoline, really.
All right, Dan, we're wrapping it up here. Man, I like hearing your recap of the energy sector. I really enjoy how much you dive into the individual companies. And one other thing we should note is that Dan is offering all of you, our listeners, a special discount on the Energy Prospectus Group membership. Use the promo code CF100, that is CF100, when you are signing up to get that $100 off. I will also post that in the weekend show posting, along with the description of this interview. If you have any trouble with that, you can email Shad or I. We will be sure to get your information over to Dan and get you that discount. Dan, really appreciate your comments. And everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. I hope you enjoyed the topics we covered. I also hope you went back and listened to some of the daily editorials and company updates throughout this week. Please keep in touch with Shad and I. We love hearing from each and every one of you. Dan, everyone, have a great rest of your weekend.
Hey, thanks a lot.